This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome. This is our bonus Q&A episode from your friends at Books of the Year. This is to go with Erin Kelly. So Erin Kelly's new book is The House of Mirrors, which we've already discussed, which that podcast landed a few days ago. But Erin is still here. She's been hanging around. And now we can put these questions to Erin. First of all, what is the last book, Erin, that you really, really enjoyed reading?
So the last book that I enjoyed to the point where I was carrying it around the house from room to room because I couldn't bear to put it down, is a memoir called Cloistered by a former nun called Catherine Coldstream.
And that's a great name as well.
Isn't it? Yeah. Born to be a novelist, if not necessarily a nun. And it is a memoir. And I find that increasingly I turn to memoir for fun, because it's harder and harder for me to read novels for pleasure, not just because I can't really switch my creative writing brain off and start thinking, oh, I can see what's coming here, or, you know, I would have cut that chapter, which I actually don't do if a book is very well written. But I know with a memoir that I am going to be completely dropped into another life. And now the pleasure of a memoir that is as beautifully written as a wonderful literary novel, which Cloistered is something to really savour. So every single page has got me underlining sentences that are just perfectly put together. It's really rich in detail. It's really unflinching and honest. And it's also about an experience that is out of time, but also happened in the modern world. So she, I'm not quite sure of the timeline now, but it was, you know, it's certainly within this century. She decided to join a convent, felt the call, and embarked on a way of life that is completely ancient, and yet she was practicing. And it's an insight into a really beautiful, intelligent mind. And I'm very fascinated by clever religious people, because the in my corner of the world, most people pride themselves on their atheism. They, you know, it is the choice of the rational, educated person. And so when somebody who is clearly so bright and so articulate has a faith that they can defend and argue about and examine doubt in, I find that really fascinating. But it is so gripping. It's the most wonderful book.
Okay, so it's called Cloistered by Catherine Coldstream.
Yeah.
And it's American?
No, she's a British writer.
And is she still with us?
Yeah, she's not much older than me, I don't think.
Wow.
It was only published, so we're halfway through March now, and it was only published a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, wow. Okay. So the last book that I carried around was yours, and I was reading
on... Look where that got you.
I know. Exactly. But I also... So my commute is either listening to podcasts or reading a book, and your book stopped me listening to podcasts, because when I'm on the tube, I'm reading House of Mirrors, not listening to podcasts.
I do genuinely think about that. When I'm writing the opening to a book, I am very aware that I'm not just in competition with, you know, whoever else is on the 3-for-2 at Waterstones. I am in competition with Facebook and podcasts and news feeds and all the myriad ways that we have to distract ourselves. So Yeah, I do. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
When you're writing a book, how many books are you taking out of the library for research?
Well, I don't take any books out of the library because if I need a book for research, I will generally I'll buy it or it won't be the kind of book that you can buy at affordable prices. So I go down really quite specific niches. For example, the book I'm writing now that won't be out till next year, I needed to learn a lot about the psychology of the boarding school student. And the only place I could access that book for free was the Welcome Library, medical library, that's free if you're but you have to join in central London and you can't take those books out. So, if I'm going to use a library book, I will stay in the library because they tend to be quite weird academic texts that cost 50 quid. Or if it's a book that I'm reading for colour, I will have it because I want it and I want to love it. And also I kind of live in hope that one day I'll get to adapt one of my own books for TV. And so I want to hang on to that source material because it might inspire me anew if I have to go back.
If you order books online, it's very weird, isn't it? Because if I'm buying your book online, I know roughly what it's going to cost. As soon as you want a book that might be an academic book, suddenly it's like £79.25. Yeah. Where did 79 come from?
I don't know the scale economics of academic publishing, but it's definitely a completely different scale, isn't it?
I needed a book, it was to do with the history of Jamaica for this book that I'm writing. Anyway, and I needed to have this particular book by a particular author. It was only this book. And that cost me £48 because it's an academic book, and apparently that's just a fairly standard price. Obviously, if you don't sell many, you have to hike the price up. Anyway, do you have a favourite place to set your novels?
I don't have a favourite. Well, I suppose I do, actually, not consciously. I have tended to set my novels in London, generally North London, just because I'm lazy and really, really busy. And I can always get there for research. So The House of Mirrors, for example, takes place largely in Camden Passage and in a suburb called Drayton Park, which is sort of the shadow of the Emirates Stadium.
And the Horror House of Highgate.
And the Horror House of Highgate, yeah, which is the setting for a lot of the 1997 passages in the book. So I do write with places that I am comfortable with. I also like to be able to walk my neighbourhoods, and sometimes if the worms are oncoming, instead of sitting at my desk looking at a blank screen, I will hop on the train and just walk around, and I will always notice something that I can use. And I write about Suffolk a lot because my mum lives there and I spend a lot of time there. And other than that, sometimes I just go where the story needs me to go. So the one I'm working on at the moment is set in Yorkshire because I needed somewhere, this is very, very specific, but I needed a convent that wouldn't have been completely sacked during the Reformation of the Church of England.
Okay.
So I needed an intact abbey, and I also needed there to be a ruined abbey nearby. And Yorkshire was the most likely place for that. It's also where there are still wild ravens. So that is a very... So
what a Venn diagram that was.
If you Google Yorkshire, working abbey, ruined abbey, ravens...
Well, you'll find a place that doesn't exist because I made it up. Okay, but those were the ingredients. Okay. And the next book I'm writing, I want to set in Venice.
Of course you do.
Because, quite frankly, three stops down the road to Drayton Park wasn't very exciting a lot of the time.
Do you have a favourite place to read? I've got to the point now where I can't, as soon as I sit down on the tube, I need to be opening up a book. It becomes odd for me to sit down and not have a book on the tube. Do you have a favourite place?
No, I can read anywhere, and I do read anywhere, short of crossing roads and walking down busy streets. I've usually got a book on the go. I've got several on the go. I read in the bath, on the loo, sorry to say, but we all do it. And at least it's not my phone, which I then carry around with me. And that is disgusting. in bed, on the sofa, like anywhere but a moving car, because within 3 or 4 minutes of reading in a moving car, I'll throw up.
Are you good at blocking out sort of distractions? By distractions, I don't mean your phone. I mean like kids, other people.
They're used to being ignored in favour of a book. I consider it modelling good practice.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
We always like to surprise our guests with a question from a fellow author.
Oh.
And fan. Here is a voice note question from Jane Casey.
Hi, Simon. Hi, Matt. And hello, Erin. You know I'm one of your biggest fans, Erin, and I would love to know, what's the strangest thing you've ever done as research for a book?
What's the strangest thing I've ever done as research for a book? I don't know that I do many strange things.
I was going to say, how do you...
I mean, killed a man.
I was going to suggest that push someone off a cliff.
No, I do know that I went to spend some time in Devon when I was writing my third book, The Burning Air, just to get a feel. And that was another example of a place where I wanted to set it during a tar barrels festival, which is one of those bonkers pagan dating things where people in the village of Ottery St. Mary's strap flaming barrels of tar on their backs and then charge through the streets on bonfire night.
What's the attraction there?
I could have told you when I was writing that book, but I haven't held the details in my mind.
Sounds like something from It's a Knockout for our older listeners.
Yeah, it's probably, you know, medieval traditions. It's probably to do with the harvest, because these things usually are, aren't they? If you go back, or the gunpowder plot,
or fertility,
something like that. Yeah. Anyway, I found myself staying in a spa, because I often find that when I do take myself off on little writing retreats, often you can get a really good deal in a spa hotel in the middle of the week, because no one's there. But I was the only person there, and it was a sort of converted manor house. And everywhere I went, I had 6 or 7 staff hovering over me for everything. It was proper horror film. You know, I was just waiting for them to all peel off their masks to have sort of blank gold faces underneath or something. So I'm afraid I haven't, as far as I can remember, done anything outlandish myself. I'm very, very risk averse, which is why it suits me to write about dangerous situations and not be in them.
Sounds as though Jane Casey might have done quite a few weird things.
Yeah.
Well, Jane Casey is married to a criminal barrister who also serves as a special constable. So she has her own source of inspiration on the sofa next to her in the evening.
Maybe she married him as research.
Yeah. I don't think he was one then, so I think it just worked out really well.
Yeah. Okay. Played the long game. If you hadn't become a journalist and a writer, Erin, what other profession would we have found you in?
Oh, I would have liked to have been in advertising. I think that might
you would?
Have been...
Wow. Okay, yeah. Right. That's a first.
As a creative, I hasten to add, and this was before I even saw Mad Men, so I wasn't influenced by that. And I think I would have also loved to go into production design. So either location scouting or set dressing or set design, or maybe stage makeup or costume design, something like that.
So because one of our characters in your book is involved in...
A bit of unlived life going on through that there, yeah. But I would have... I don't think I would be very good at any job that didn't involve some kind of creativity or storytelling, because it's somewhere to put all my misfiring synapses. Anything that involved administration or looking after somebody else.
Particularly liked in House of Mirrors just that idea that something that you're wearing has a story.
Mm.
You know, we're used to a house having a story, or the town or the city being a character in a movie. But the idea that a dress that had been worn before actually felt part of the dress that you were buying into that, I thought was fantastic.
Yeah, well, I do that a lot. I mean, the wedding ring that I'm wearing now is actually my grandmother's wedding ring. And it was all I wanted when she died. So I wear that now. And I was 18 when she died, so it's a long, long time, but it means she's there every day. Now, we all have something personal like that, and that's a known story. And I've got a bunch of my mum's old 70s clothes. Every summer I wear the skirt she wore when she was pregnant with me in the heatwave of 76. And that's very beautiful and something we can all relate to. But I also have lots of dresses that I know came from people, and I shop at vintage fairs a lot, and I meet the sellers at the markets, and sometimes they'll say, oh, this came from a house clearance, that, you know, it was an old woman who was a cabaret singer or an actress, or, you know, she was an heiress and then she ran out of money, but here are all her fox fur stoles, and she lived in poverty in a council flat along with 15 mink coats. You know, I wouldn't personally wear a mink coat, but I love the fact that they come with their own stories and that they were once treasured things and that they can come to life. And I mean, we talk a lot about landfill garments now. The clothes themselves tend to, you know, fast fashion is badly made, and even if the fabrics are indestructible, but clothes, the further back you go, the more beautifully made things are, and they really were made to last. So anything that was made during the war, for example, would have had an extra 3 or 4 inches in the seams, because you could take it out if you put on a bit of weight and then you would take it back in again. And I love the idea of wearing a two-piece suit that someone in the Wrens wore through the skinny years when she was living off rations and then kept when peace came. I think that's beautiful and really inspirational.
Do you have a favourite author that you've met?
Well, I like loads of, I don't know, I meet so many other authors for the course of my work that it's impossible to single one out. So no, I don't have a favourite.
That either means you're being cautious or you just don't like authors. Yeah.
No, I'm genuinely struggling to pick a favourite.
I couldn't name one of them because they're all fabulous and yes.
Sorry, that's a really short answer.
No, it's fine.
We've talked about where you read. You can read anywhere. Where do you write best?
I write in the box room in my house, and I write best there just because the ergonomics are set up exactly the way I like and need them. So when I first went freelance in my early 20s, I used to write on a cardboard folding table and a dining room chair on a laptop, and it took years of Pilates and physio to undo that damage. So I have a nice expensive swivelly chair and a standy uppy desk and a monitor at the exact right height and everything I need around me. So I don't write particularly well on the move. I wish I could. It'd be much more efficient, but I don't.
Finally. Well, I hope maybe you could write in Venice, you know.
Well, that would be more of inspiration gathering. Okay. That would be writing things longhand in my notebook and voice notes to self.
Finally, you are throwing a fantasy dinner party and you can invite three authors, living or dead. Who's coming?
Do you know what? I'm just going to say that I want my mates, because I don't particularly enjoy all of my hero authors who inspired me the most. I wouldn't want to talk to them because I don't want to let light in on magic. So I wouldn't actually want to meet Ruth Rendell or Emily Bronte or Patricia Highsmith. I mean, I really wouldn't want to meet Patricia Highsmith. She was absolutely vile by all accounts. I spend so much time talking to authors that I know about the work they're doing that I would like to have my very favourite books from authors who aren't with us anymore staying like they are and not lift the lid.
We're going to need three names from you.
Okay, well, Jane Casey, who I was going to say even before you just played a question from her.
With her very well-connected husband, yes, apparently.
Yeah. So yeah, Jane Casey, Ruth Ware, Sarah Hillary, just because I've had dinner with them all before and I know it'd be really good fun.
Okay, and if they're listening to the podcast, they might take offence if they're not included at this point.
Yeah.
Oh, I've probably offended all my other mates now, but I don't care. They're the ones I want for my fantasy dinner party. Although it's not really much of a fantasy, because I could probably make it happen
with
a couple of WhatsApps.
You could actually do that tonight, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, despite the disappointing answer at the end, Erin Kelly, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
The House of Mirrors is published by Hodders and is out now. Remember, if you want to get in touch, email at any time, booksoftheyear@yahoo.com or via the socials. Back next week, our guest is going to be the international best-selling author and investigative journalist Tom Burgess. Until then, goodbye. Thank you for listening.